the Fox News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan, it's the fastest growing radio talk show, Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everybody. Wild day. It's going to be a busy, busy show. Peter Schweitzer is going to be on with us in a little while and talk about the all hands-on-deck approach that China's doing in every way imaginable against America, from our border to fentanyl to what they're doing, threatening to do to Taiwan, to how they're replenishing with dual-use weapons and parts, Russia, let alone the oil that they're buying from Iran. Peter Schweitzer on that. Admiral James Stavridis is standing by, and we have a lot to discuss about, especially what happened overnight. So let's get to the big three.
Now, with the stories you need to know, it's Brian's Big Three.
Number three.
The average person really does want to put bias aside. The problem is that you have highly motivated people in New York, and some of them, I think, could very well lie on the stand and not disclose their bias, the hatred towards Trump.
You think? Trump trial day four, jury selection on a breakneck pace makes me uneasy. And the latest on the 2024 presidential contest with new battleground polls are out, with and without RFK.
Number two.
Students have a right to free speech, but do not have a right to violate university policies and disrupt learning on campus. That hot break does not give you the right to harass others, to spread hate.
That is Mayor Eric Adams. Columbia crackdown. I'm talking about university. The pro-Palestinian, pro-Hamas Ivy exposes themselves as an anti-American bastion. Time now to suspend the heretics wreaking havoc on our city streets, and not only in Columbia, but around the country.
Number one.
I think the most important question for the Israelis is, what do they want to achieve here? And I think they made up their mind that they wanted to achieve a limited, narrow attack to de-escalate the situation, and it would not put pressure on Iran to retaliate.
Israel attacks Iran in Iran. As the sun comes up, we review the damage as Iran finds a interesting way to respond and what it all means for American forces in the region with the 22,000 plus, especially on right in Iraq, very close. And by the way, Iran could go anywhere in Iraq. It's almost it's a vassal state to them, it seems. Admiral James Stavridis joins us now. His book is now out, doing well, called 2054, a novel of the next world war. And, you know, depending on what happens next, we could be in the middle of it. Admiral, welcome back. From what you know, what did Israel accomplish last night?
I think the way to approach this is that Israel wanted to show Iran, hey, we can come in through the window, we can come in through the door, we can be in your house, we can effectively target anything in your country. They picked out, from my eye, a couple of pretty important places, particularly the city of Isfahan, south of Tehran. It's about the third largest city in Iran. So what the Israelis set out to do, and I think General Jack Keane laid it out well, conduct a limited attack, demonstrate your capabilities, but don't do something that'll escalate the situation.
So what they did is hit between a military base, and they hit there and the Natanz nuclear facility, and it's an unmanned craft. And we know, according to Reuters, that says Iran is reporting that they didn't even credit Israel with the strike. They said their missile defense knocked objects out of the sky. We think it was three cruise missiles, do we think? And do we think that they landed anywhere? Do you know?
We just don't know yet. I suspect, as you say, sun comes up, you get a better look from our overhead sensors. So look for the Pentagon to put out a little more data on the battle damage assessment. If you want a pure guess on my part, I'd say probably drones. I would doubt cruise missile. The drone gives you what you need in this scenario, which is, again, just to show the Iranians you can get through. Iran will continue to say, oh, no, we knocked everything down. I doubt it. Let's hear some more before we make a final judgment. But I'd score it a success on the part of the Israelis in terms of accomplishing what they set out to do.
So their foreign minister came here, was willing to speak to certain networks. And before the strike happened, it happened hours after these interviews were released. Here's a little of what he had to say about the strike last weekend inside Israel. Cut 15.
Our response to the Israeli regime was limited and stayed within a minimum of frameworks, whereas we could have given a much harsher response to the Israeli regime.
You think they could have?
Not from mainland Iran. I think, in fairness, the tool they have that they have not used are the 100,000-plus very close to Israel surface-to-surface missiles under control of one of their proxies, Hezbollah, just north of Israel in southern Lebanon. If Iran chose to unleash that barrage, that could do some real damage to the state of Israel. But I think the Iranians hit them with pretty much their full range of capabilities, drones, ballistic missiles, cruise missiles. And as has been famously pointed out, they shot 350 of these things and virtually none of them got through.
Admiral Stavridis, our guest. Admiral, it came out this week that in a report that fentanyl not only is produced in China, but there's incentives for the corporations to make it and export it, especially to Mexico. So they said, whatever, as long as you don't leave it here, we export it and we know exactly what it's going to do. Now we're foolishly debating as if there's another side to it, whether TikTok should not be forced to be sold or banned in this country. We know that that's also part of the disinformation campaign they plan on doing. And now we have confirmation from the White House itself that says that they are giving dual use weapons and replenishing the weapons or the military arsenal of the Russians. So they're fomenting unrest everywhere they can. Your thoughts about what we should be doing?
We should be increasing the pressure on Iran. And that means, sure, we can put a few more sanctions on. But I think the next logical series of steps here are to go directly after the proxies, turn up the heat on the Houthis down in Yemen, continue to pressure these militia groups in Iraq and Syria. But, Brian, I think it's time we began to go after Iranian assets directly. And I'd probably start, maybe this is just the old admiral in me talking, but I would probably start with Iranian assets at sea. Just a couple of days ago, by the way, the Iranian Navy, in an act of complete piracy, took down a big merchant ship that is tied economically to the state of Israel. Just took it down, piracy on the high seas by a sovereign state. I think it's time to respond to that, and I would start by taking out or at least considering attacking some of the Iranian naval assets that are underway at sea that are conducting these kind of operations. So I think it's time to begin to close in on Iran, and I think we can do that without fomenting an all-out war in the Middle East.
How do you feel about the repo act they're putting out to start looking at Russian assets and repurposing them, just taking them? Some people say, well, it's a great idea. Russia's an outlaw state who's looking to expand. And other people say it gives you another incentive to leave the international banking community and that it might be a bad precedent. What's your thoughts?
Yeah, I think you can make a case on both sides of that argument. Personally, I come down on the side of, if you will, the Repo Act, a good way to put it. These are about $300 to $400 billion in Russian assets that are in Western financial institutions. I don't think we should take them and use them domestically here or allow other people to garnish them and use them other than Ukraine. Ukraine is the disadvantaged party. They've been invaded. They've had their power grid repeatedly attacked. Their military is having enormous challenges. Hey, let's use that money to allow them reconstruction and permit them the opportunity to stand toe-to-toe with Russia. I think it makes a lot of sense. It's an extreme case, but this strikes me as a moment for using those funds in that way.
So I'm sure you've noticed what's happening in Columbia University. I'm sure you know that these Ivy League presidents have been asked to come to Capitol Hill to defend the anti-Semitism that's been fomented on their campuses. I want you to hear a little bit about the chaos from the chaos yesterday, because you headed up a prestigious institution too. Cut 28.
So what happened when you were in custody? You got taken from campus. They handcuffed you. And what happened?
Well, we sang spirituals all the way down to the jailhouse. We sang hymns of revolution. We sang folk songs. We sang about all you fascists being bound to lose, all the military-industrial complex, corporate-endorsed Zionist-backed institutions.
And there was thousands. And the hundreds were suspended. And you saw these mini pup tents that popped up in the middle of the campus. Listen, protests are a part of it. We know, especially in the 60s, I understand it. Did you ever think on American campuses the pro-Palestinian, pro-Hamas movement would take root like it has?
No, I could never have conceived that. And you listen to that young student who sounds like he's high on something and walked out of a time warp in the 1960s. That's all old think. What we need to be doing is standing with Israel against terrorist organizations like Hamas. To me, that's just not a complicated question at this point.
So what happened? Well, I mean, why would these – you know what kind of grade – you know this. Do you know what grade you need to get into Columbia? What you need – unless you have a legacy situation? So I know that, you know, most people I know wouldn't even apply there when we were getting out of high school. So these are not knuckleheads. Even though they're acting like that, I seem. So what's going on?
I think this is well documented. College faculties, kind of 75 to 80% of the tenured faculty who you can't move on, kind of came out of that 60s movement, and they carry that torch and they pass it along to some of these young students. Now, let's be honest here. You can look across the spectrum of 4,000 institutions in this country that grant bachelor degrees, and that idea of supporting a terrorist organization like Hamas is, my view, a very small percentage. But it is happening disproportionately, here's your point, Brian, in these hyper-elite Ivy League schools. And I think that it is way past time for deans and presidents and provosts, and I've been the dean of a high-end law school at Tufts University. It's time that the reality check be part of the conversation on these campuses, and clearly in some of them it has not been so.
I worry about them being financed by outside organizations along with the professors, but I also think people getting paid. I think people are getting paid to foment unrest in our country. We're easily manipulated. I think we got to open up our eyes to it.
I agree. And it's not just people inside the United States doing it.
Yeah.
This is part of a highly targeted campaign by Russia and China. It goes back to the TikTok piece of this. We should not have an institution as influential as TikTok be owned by effectively a company that is under the thumb of the Chinese Communist Party. That's how some of this is gaining root and influencing. Hey, final thought. I'd love to just hear some tape from midshipmen at the U.S. Naval Academy and cadets at West Point and cadets out at the Air Force Academy and ROTC units at University of Florida, University of Georgia, University of Vermont. There are many, many wonderful students in these campuses, but at the moment we are focused on a minority, but I think a minority who are absolutely in the wrong place on this issue.
Right. I'm very cognizant of not blowing up situations that disproportionately the best I can. And when you shut down what they shut down yesterday and they shut down those bridges on Monday in every major city in the country, and most of them are young people. So I do think that they're trying to have their voice heard. And I think that we just got to wonder who's behind it. And just so you know, to put it in perspective, full circle, yesterday, China made it clear that Meta platforms, WhatsApp, and Threads are now, as well as Signal and Telegram, were taken off the Chinese App Store. So they're taking our guys off. and we're actually debating whether we should be taken off TikTok. It's nuts. Admiral.
It is totally.
Admiral, everybody, go out and pick up 2054, a novel, The Next World War. Use all your military know-how, along with your co-author, to really give us a perspective of what's straight ahead. Admiral, thanks so much.
Pleasure, Brian. See you down here soon.
Absolutely.
Bye-bye.
Back in a moment. Brian Kilmeade Show. Peter Schweitzer at the bottom of the hour. We'll talk more about China, and I'll take your calls. I know if you watched any of that yesterday, you have a lot to say, including Congresswoman Omar's daughter, who's now a mini celebrity. Don't move.
Giving you everything you need to know. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
Listen to the all-new Brett Baer podcast featuring Common Ground, in-depth talks with lawmakers from opposite sides of the aisle, along with all your Brett Baer favorites like his all-star panel and much more. Available now at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
From his mouth to your ears, it's Brian Kilmeade.
We have to go back to maximum pressure. We have to focus on closing and shutting down the resources that Iran has to mass produce these drones, build these ballistic missiles, pay their terrorist proxies, and you know, execute the Ayatollah's vision for a ring of fire against Israel, which it fully intends to destroy.
Congressman Waltz, Green Beret, he's on Armed Services, and he says, look, it's real simple. China's buying the oil at a discount rate. They're buying Russians' oil at a discount rate. By the way, so is India. And would you go to China and say, listen, these are the tariffs that are going to go on you, and you can keep it in private so that you're not, you don't have a pride situation if you continue to buy oil from them? Or you give it such, you know, there's different things they can do, but you got to pull them out of the Iran buying oil business. It's given them billions of dollars. They use it for Hezbollah, Hamas, and their own nuclear program. We don't want that. It doesn't go to their people. It goes to foment terror. So we could do that right away. But I watched Anthony Blinken today at the G7. He talked about China being a problem with Russia and by backing them up with dual-use parts that are helping their war machine. But he didn't talk about China buying the oil from Iran, and that's intentional. They did not sanction oil in Iran. They sanctioned other elements of their drone program in other areas. Why would that be? To me, it's simple. What does this administration want to do? Two things. They want to green the economy, and they want to keep gas prices down, or they can't get reelected. So what do? You go to Venezuela and say, okay, get your stuff online. We'll buy it from you. And then we'll help you stand up your oil industry. And then they go up to Iran and said, okay, to keep that global price down, keep the world oil price down to $80, $70 a barrel, we'll let you put it out there on the market. Because if you take that away, and you still, by the way, he still has not replenished his strategic oil reserve, which is only supposed to be in times of war, natural disasters, and catastrophes, not because you want to keep the price of oil down to get reelected and not get blown away in the midterms. Now, if you pull the oil, the Iranian oil out, then that's going to affect the price, wouldn't it? Of course it would. So it's all about the election. Which is scary. Can you imagine when this group doesn't have to worry about re-election? How left-wing they will become? Guaranteed. That's why, for so many reasons, more and more people are saying what I'm saying. Is Trump got to win?
A talk show that's real. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Simply put, without China's production and export of fentanyl and fentanyl precursors, there would be no fentanyl crisis in the United States. And the mass slaughter would effectively stop.
That is a billboard. And we talked about fentanyl and the revelations that these corporations in China that make fentanyl, they got incentivized to create it and send it out. As long as you will get, you'll get additional commissions as long as it leaves the country. And you know where it heads, to the southern border in America, part of a totally comprehensive covert mission to destroy us without firing a shot. And I think that TikTok is absolutely a part of that. And fentanyl is another thing coming through our border that literally is killing at least 200 Americans a day. Peter Schweitzer, president of the Government Accountability Institute, best-selling author. His latest bestseller is new book is Blood Money, Why the Powerful Turn a Blind Eye While China Kills Americans. Peter, welcome back.
Great to be with you always, Brian. Thanks for having me.
So I guess you agree. You agree with what Bill Barr says. He sees your urgency.
Yeah, I would go a step further, though. Yes, the precursors do come from China, and yes, they do subsidize it. But every link in the chain is a China operation. The drug cartels are the junior partners. Those precursors arrive at the port of Manzanillo in Mexico, Brian. That terminal, that international terminal, is not run by a Mexican company, by a Chinese company. Those precursors go to a town in northern Mexico where 2,000 Chinese nationals, according to the DEA, create the fentanyl out of the precursors for the drug cartels. Every link in the chain China is running, including the money laundering. The cartels used to use Latin American banks to launder their profits. In the era of fentanyl, they use Chinese state-owned banks now to launder their money. So this is a Chinese operation with the drug cartels as the junior partners.
So what's new about this new revelation, that they're actually incentivizing these corporations to do just that? And when President Xi tells President Biden, he acts mystified by how this is happening, but he promises to look into it. Is there an ounce of sincerity?
No, there's not. Look, China tries to say, you know, we're trying to deal with this problem. It's criminal conduct. It's not criminal conduct. 40% of the companies exporting the precursors to Mexico are Chinese state-owned companies that are run by politically connected people. There are several leaders of Chinese organized crime networks that are advisors to the CCP. In fact, in 2021, a gentleman named Mr. Wan was sanctioned by the Biden administration Treasury Department for his involvement in the fentanyl trade. Guess what? After he was sanctioned by our Treasury Department publicly, the Chinese government gave Mr. Wan an award, and he gave a defiant speech where he said, I'm proud of the fact of what I'm doing because it's essentially revenge for the opium wars. So any claim that they don't know about this or they're trying to deal with it is false. The CCP actually works with Chinese organized crime on multiple levels, and this is just one manifestation of it.
Do they know we had nothing to do with the opium wars? That was the British?
Yes, they do know that, but they, of course, lump it all together as part of the West. And this looms really large for President Xi. I mean, he put this into the Chinese curriculum so young people in China never forget the opium wars, which at one point, one quarter of every person in China was allegedly taking opium. And this is really what led to the century of humiliation. But for President Xi, this is kind of an accepted tactic. President Xi reveres his father. Brian, he even built a large mausoleum in his honor. His father was a revolutionary figure with Mao. One of his father's great acts of service, I'll put that in quotation marks, was actually at the age of 14 poisoning his teacher because his teacher was not sufficiently revolutionary. President Xi thinks that was actually a noble act. So the notion that you're using things to punish your enemies in this way is not something that President Xi thinks is necessarily a bad thing.
It's so interesting, too, because I heard his dad was abused by the government, correct?
Yes.
And he had a tougher upbringing because of that. You would think he'd be more of a reformer.
Yeah, you would. His father was ultimately rehabilitated, but you're exactly right, Brian. I mean, it's a paradox. His father was purged by the Maoists, but later on, he was rehabilitated. Xi, rather than this making him softer, has actually made him harder. You also need to just look at Xi's wife. Xi's wife is a very famous singer in China. The night after Tiananmen Square, when an estimated 10,000 civilians were massacred by members of the People's Liberation Army, President Xi's wife, to whom he was already married, she serenaded the troops that participated in that massacre. So this is a very, very hardened man and family. And you're right. You would think he would have learned some lessons from the repression of the past. He's actually learned the opposite lesson, which is to be hard and tough and direct.
Peter, one thing about you, you'll take aim at Republicans, Democrats, wherever the money leads. And one thing is pretty clear. A lot of Republicans, especially Rand Paul, are getting money from, I think it's Jeff Yass, who is the lead investor of TikTok here in America. And now suddenly Senator Rand Paul, who saw China as a problem, Senator Rand Paul is like, oh, we're a free market. Let's not be afraid of an app. Let's leave TikTok alone.
Yeah, look, and I have enormous respect for Rand Paul, but he is dead wrong on this, and I think the money from Jeff Ass has a lot to do with it. A couple of things people have to keep in mind. Number one, ByteDance, the parent company that controls TikTok, is not just a Chinese company, Brian. It is wedded to the Chinese intelligence state. That algorithm which drives TikTok, that makes it so powerful and effective, it's not just a company secret. The Chinese government in 2020 designated it as a state secret. That's how valuable they view this. ByteDance does a lot of research with the Chinese Ministry of State Security. I talk about this in Blood Money. And some of that research involves how to manipulate people online emotionally. And finally, what I would say is, you know, Rand Paul has said, well, look, this is a company that's got American investors. Fortune magazine has reported a while ago that all of the American and foreign investors in ByteDance signed an agreement that says if they criticize or disparage the company publicly, their shares can be taken away without compensation. So this is not a company in any regular sense of the word. And it's not just a Chinese company. It is a Chinese company that is wedded to the military-industrial complex of Beijing.
And people don't understand that. They said there's a Texas project, which means that they'll be able to keep our information here. Do you buy the Texas project?
No, we live in the era of this thing called the World Wide Web, which means you can move data around on the internet. And just because you have some servers in Texas doesn't mean they can't make their way back to China. In fact, some former employees have already said that that has happened. But I think even more to the point, there are the data concerns, which we have to be worried about. But on the side of propaganda, one of the things I do in Blood Money, Brian, is I actually quote extensively from Chinese officials. These are military officials, propaganda officials, talking about how they are already using TikTok to manipulate the emotions of young people in the West. One military officer calls it the ultimate Trojan horse. In other instances, they talk about how getting young people emotionally wrapped up on online gives them the ability through TikTok to steer the direction of the views that they're going to embrace and the attitudes that they're going to have. So we may be debating here whether they're using it as propaganda. The debate in China is already settled. They're already doing it according to their own words.
And they're lobbying hard as of this week to make sure the Senate never puts it up for a vote. But the House did the right thing with over 300 votes. And I believe legislation over the weekend could push it forward. So how surprised are you, and with my tongue firmly on my cheek, that the Secretary of State, Anthony Blinken, did not call out China from buying cheap oil from Iran? He said, we're going to sanction their drone program, go after their steel, but we're not going to go after their oil sales to Iran. Excuse me, to China.
No. No, you're exactly right, Brian. This is an example of what the Chinese call elite capture. The notion that you sort of forge these bonds with political leaders in other countries. And what they're looking for, in their words, is big help with a little bad mouth. I mean, in other words, they know that Biden and Blinken have to criticize them from time to time for the Uyghurs or human rights. But what they want is help on the big things. And the Biden administration has given them everything on China. Joe Biden has said, for example, that he is not going to point the finger at China with regards to fentanyl, which is absurd given the fact that Beijing is absolutely in the middle of it. And to your point, when it comes to oil in China, when it comes to a whole host of other problems that we're facing, Joe Biden will not call them out. I highlight in the book, for example, Brian, this problem with Glock switches, these small devices that are highly illegal. Since 2018, according to our Department of Homeland Security, China has smuggled thousands of these in the United States. What do? They convert a handgun into a fully automatic machine gun, and they sold them to gang members and criminals in the United States. So our cops are outgunned. Does Joe Biden raise this issue with China? No. He wants to go after the Second Amendment rights of ordinary Americans.
I just wanted to just read you, and I think you kind of covered it, but just in case for our listeners, because this is a debate. TikTok's a popular app, and I know people make money on it. I'm not being callous to their cause. They're not interested in the news feed. They get their business. They're running image ads on Fox News. So this is Christy Amorthy. He's the Democrat on the China Select Committee. He said ByteDance basically has its editor-in-chief, who's also the secretary of the Chinese Communist Party cell, embedded at the highest echelons of the company to control all of its products. And he's been tasked with, quote, making sure all of its products, including TikTok, adhere to a correct political direction. And that is a different type of threat than we've ever seen before. So they have to, everybody with technology has to open up that technology to the government, no matter what it is. I don't care if you're a military situation or social media situation. They have no choice.
Right. That's exactly right. If you're in China, the CCP tells you to do it, you do it. More to the point, the example you just gave is right. All the senior editorial positions at ByteDance, the parent company that controls TikTok, every editorial position there is run by an individual who either A, is a member, a senior ranking member of the Communist Party, or B, worked in the propaganda ministry of the CCP, or C, worked for Chinese state media. That's who controls editorial policy. Why is that? Because they recognize the power and the value of this app and its ability, in their words, to wage cognitive warfare on the United States. It's not just about propaganda, Brian. It's what they're feeding to young people in America. Our TikTok is giving, by and large, young people, these pranks, women with blue hair screaming about something, silly dances. China has the equivalent to TikTok that they give to young people there. It's called Douyin. In Douyin, you do not get people with blue hair screaming strange things. You get science experiments. You get history. You get culture. They're giving our kids cotton candy.
Yep.
They're feeding their kids spinach. And this is part of what they call cognitive warfare.
All right. Why do you think we're getting all these Chinese with the roller bags that look like they just stopped off an American Airlines jet coming through our southern border?
Well, we know a lot of them are actually involved in illegal marijuana grow operations in the United States. In the state of Maine alone, just the state of Maine, there are 300 known illegal marijuana grows. This is pot that's far more potent than the stuff sold legally. It's organized by Chinese organized crime. And the workers that work at these places when they raided are overwhelmingly Chinese nationals that are in the country illegally. So, and part of it is this Chinese organized crime effort in the United States with the cooperation of the CCP to engage in criminal activity. That is a big, big part of it. And we need to start getting our hands on it, not just sealing the border, but dealing with those that are already in the country.
See, I had somebody on that was telling me it's a terrible country. China's cracking down on personal rights. You know the Uyghur issues. Why wouldn't China want to leave? And I go, wait a second. You can't leave unless they give you a visa. It's not up to you if you can leave and they keep the rest of your family hostage. You know, we already know the drill. And I just thought to myself, maybe I'm missing something.
No, you're not missing anything, Brian. And these smuggling networks in Central America are organized by Chinese criminal gangs. And the CCP and the Chinese organized crime have been working together since the 1980s. Deng Xiaoping, the leader, met with the triad leaders, Chinese organized crime, and said, look, as long as you're patriotic and you support the CCP, we'll let you do whatever activity you want overseas, and we will protect you. In other words, if foreign governments want you to come back to stand trial, we will protect you. And that is the alliance that has been in play from the beginning. And that is what you're seeing today. So somebody who is arriving in the United States from Mexico across the border got there through a smuggling network that was supported by the Chinese government. They're not here because they are dissidents.
And they're not going through the Darien Gap. They don't look all grimy. They're not all washed out. They look like they just maybe had a 12-hour flight somewhere. And didn't get any and weren't able to put their tray table up. They look like they just did. They're checking in at LaGuardia. Peter, it's all in your book. It's all about blood money, why the powerful turn a blind eye while China kills Americans, at least 200 a day. Peter, thank you.
Great to see you as always, Brian. Thanks.
All right. Listen, we come back. I'll have a few minutes on the other end. We have so much more to cover. We didn't even bring up what happened with the Columbia students yesterday. We're going to be also talking about a little bit more details on the strike last night, Israel inside Iran, and what President Trump is looking at in the courtroom. Wow. A lot to do. So glad you're here.
Learning something new every day on the Brian Kilmeade Show. A radio show like no other. It's Brian Kilmeade.
This was carefully calibrated. The Israelis felt compelled to respond to show that they could reach Iran if need be. They could hurt them if need be, but they didn't hurt them this time. The fact that the Iranians are downplaying it at home suggests to me they don't feel compelled to retaliate against the retaliation. I think this is showed the Bibi Netanyahu were often critical. I think in this case, he resisted what he was getting pressured to do from his right. He did less rather than more. I think the Biden administration should feel pretty good in terms of calming down the reactions. And I think, excuse me, this is also a realization on the Israelis. They've got their hands full. So I think this is really an interesting case. You see it sometimes, short during the Cold War, Joe, that adversaries figure out how to signal. There's nothing formal. There's nothing explicit. But I think what we saw here is some actually sophisticated signaling and messaging by Israel and Iran.
And what Richard Haass is talking about from the Council of Foreign Relations is the hit last night really didn't do much damage, it seems. We don't have everything for sure, but it was intentional. They wanted no casualties. They wanted to send a message to Iran. We can touch you at any point, anywhere. And what am I talking about? Right in the town, right in a town, a city, in between a military base and in between the Natanz nuclear facility, they sent a message and blew up some stuff. And they tested the missile defense. But they got deep into Iran. There's no neighbors that were tipping them off. And if you think about it, we've got to get details. But this had to go over Iraq and Jordan. Jordan was knocking down drones for Israel. They were not doing anything at all to help Iran to tip them off. So both sides want to de-escalate. And I think that's what Richard Haass is saying. Nobody wants a world war, but you can't have the status quo. The thing is, Iran can have the status quo because they're getting money. But you know who can't have the status quo? Israel. They have to go 200 miles off their northern border. There's rockets still coming from Hamas through Gaza. And they got to eliminate the whole Hamas government and get rid of what they say is roughly a battalion left in Rafah. So the status quo is not okay. And what is Iran going to do if they were able to neutralize Hamas? That's key.
News headquarters in New York City. Always seeking solutions, never sowing division. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Brian Kilmeade Show. I come to you from 48th and 6th in Midtown Manhattan. It's really where everything's taking place. Think about this. A former president of the United States is being tried downtown, uptown at Columbia, one of the most famous colleges in the country, in the world, university, the site of massive unrest. As relates now, I guess there's a sense that the Palestinian movement is the American movement. If you could tell me anything the Palestinians stand for that reminds you of America, please jot it down and slip it underneath my door. Also, we saw 105 arrests last night. So we'll discuss that. It's all happening here and where you are. We'll be taking calls. Keep in mind, too, if you ever can't catch the show, if you leave your local affiliate, use our app. Just click on watch and just swipe. You could watch the feed, or you also could click on the headsets. Before we get to our two great guests this hour, one is Stephen Moore, former chief of staff of the U.S. House of Representatives and founder of the Ukraine Freedom Project, because we have a lot of aid that could be coming their way as early as Saturday morning. And we also have James Keyes with us, author of a brand new book, former CEO of 7-Eleven and Blockbuster. And the book is called Education is Freedom. The future is in your hands. So let's get to the big three.
Now, with the stories you need to know, it's Brian's Big Three.
Number three.
The average person really does want to put bias aside. The problem is that you have highly motivated people in New York, and some of them, I think, could very well lie on the stand and not disclose their bias, the hatred towards Trump.
That wouldn't be good. Jonathan Turley, on the fear the Trump team has. Trump trial day number four, jury selection at a breakneck pace. It makes me uneasy. And the latest on the 2024 presidential contest with new battleground polls out. We'll review them with or without RFK.
Number two.
Students have a right to free speech, but do not have a right to violate university policies and disrupt learning on campus.
And be rude.
Heartbreak does not give you the right to harass others, to spread hate.
Right. The Columbia crackdown, the pro-Palestinian, pro-Hamas Ivy League school exposes themselves as an anti-American bastion. Time now to suspend the heretics wreaking havoc on our city streets and disrespecting the NYPD.
Number one.
I think the most important question for the Israelis is, what do they want to achieve here? And I think they made up their mind that they wanted to achieve a limited, narrow attack to de-escalate the situation, and it would not put pressure on Iran to retaliate.
Israel attacks Iran in Iran. The sun comes up. We review the damage as we get it from that closed society. And Iran may or may not respond. It doesn't seem like they are. And what it all means for American forces in the region, about 2,500 right next door in Iraq. James Keyes, you know all this stuff. You follow world events. It affects the markets, affects your business. But right now, you just told me it bothers you because you went to Columbia.
I did. I was a graduate of Columbia University, of the business school. And like everyone, I'm concerned. There's no room for violence. There's no room for anti-Semitism. There's no room for hate. On the other hand, Brian, I'm concerned about the education system in America. And we've got to be really careful, I think.
What level bothers you the most?
Well, there's a narrative now. We are all frustrated with what's going on campus. But we are also beneficiaries of the best education system in the world compared to so many other countries. And we've got to be really careful about discouraging young people from going to school or getting involved. Bottom line is, education is fundamentally critical to America, all the way back to the Founding Fathers.
They talked about it.
They did. Jefferson wrote about it, that a democracy, a sustainable democracy, depends on an educated populace. And so we built one of the best education systems in the world, public school systems, secondary school systems, post-secondary, and now it's in turmoil. And that's part of the reason for my book. It's a call to action to say, let's not forget, in spite of our frustrations with the current reality, let's not forget the importance of education.
Well, first off, let's talk about you.
Yes.
So you went to Columbia.
I did.
So obviously you're somebody who was hitting the books in high school. You don't get into Columbia unless you excel and are driven. You get there, you excel. When did you jump into business?
I did. But Brian, I got there, but I didn't get there with the normal route. I literally grew up in a three-room house with no plumbing and was fortunate to be an example of the American dream. I literally worked my way through college, fought my way through to be able to afford it, got into Columbia Graduate School, and that was a path to literally, name of the book, Education is Freedom,
right,
for me.
So where did you get your drive from?
I think it came, ironically, from the adversity I faced as a kid. It's only two ways to deal with crisis, right? You have your head down, and you become a victim, and you blame others. Or you pick your head up and say, no one's going to take care of me. I have no safety net here. I have to do it myself. And in my case, thank goodness, I had that positive reaction to crisis. And throughout my life, I've found crisis equals opportunity. Change equals opportunity.
So bring me through your career path.
Sure. Out of Columbia, I ended up with an opportunity to get an internship at Gulf Oil Corporation. Sent me down to Houston, fell in love with Texas. Fell in love with the oil industry, decided that I'd go back to school, finish the MBA. They offered me a full-time job, and I ended up going to work for the CFO of Gulf Oil Corporation.
Wow. And what did you learn from him?
Well, it was a great experience because sometimes timing is really important, right? It was just as personal computers emerged. So I was just a kid, but running analysis for the CFO because they were looking for acquisition targets. And I was able to have 30 minutes after the market closed, a full valuation of crude oil reserves against market cap for every one of the top 20 oil companies.
That got people's attention.
They got people's attention.
And they got over your age.
Exactly.
So,
they got over my age. Right.
Right. So you start doing that, feel appreciated.
Absolutely.
So you end up, but as the top of your bio says, you ran 7-Eleven and Blockbuster.
I did.
So Blockbuster aged out. The concept aged out. 7-Eleven never will.
7-Eleven never will. But ironically, 7-Eleven and Blockbuster were almost mirror images. 7-Eleven in 1991 was bankrupt, filed for Chapter 11 protection. Came out of that crisis, a stronger, better company. And so when I took on the challenge of Blockbuster, it was by design. I had learned the power of technology, mm-hmm. both in my first job and at 7-Eleven.
And what year is this?
This was in 2007. I took on the challenge of being chairman and CEO of Blockbuster. Now, wow. Think about that timing.
So
not great.
Are you thinking I got to land this plane soft? I have to reinvent it.
Totally have to reinvent it. My first effort was to take it private. So I had been talking to private equity firms, trying to line up the capital to take Blockbuster back into the private markets, because I knew that the transformation and the glare and scrutiny of a public entity would be tough. Carl Icahn was lead director, talked me into just leave it a public company, and that was fine. We did quite well. In the year 2008, we doubled EBITDA. We had great progress. We bought a streaming video company from the studios, so we were well on our way, had a great competitive advantage versus Netflix. But you remember what happened in September of 2008? Lehman Brothers. We had $1 billion
market
of debt.
Collapse, yeah.
Yeah, market crash. $1 billion of debt. Great lesson in the Blockbuster experience, because it was fear ultimately among suppliers, among investors. It was fear and uncertainty that really crushed Blockbuster and forced us into a restructuring.
And you mentioned that twice. You mentioned it before, but fear is a big deal. People overreact.
It's a fundamental platform of my book. After running two big companies, I've seen it all the time. Fear is a killer of careers for individuals because they're scared, and it's a killer of companies because if fear seeps in, it'll stop us in our tracks. It creates inertia in big companies, and it causes people to either overreact or underreact.
So when you would you, from your level, you've always been an executive.
Yes.
Have you invested heavily in the workforce to find out what makes him or her tick?
Absolutely. In fact, 20 years ago at 7-Eleven, I saw a supply crisis of educated employees. If you remember, if you think about 7-Eleven, there are a lot of first-generation Americans,
sure.
Indian, Pakistani, all kinds, 130 different nationalities. What I discovered was that 7-Eleven and Subway and many of these small store operators end up being the American dream. Someone will come with $500 to the United States in their pocket. They work really hard. And the first thing they do when they're successful is send their kids to school. So my objective was to try to figure out how do we take that same recognition of the power of the American dream and remind our own kids in public schools, you can do this. Here's a path.
True. But you like me, and many people listening right now, are concerned about our schools, the quality of the schools. And people think, oh, well, that means you don't like the teachers. I'm not saying anything. I think the teachers are underappreciated and underpaid for the most part.
Yeah.
But maybe the unions and management, so to speak, of the superintendents have a different idea of how Americans should be educated. And the teachers have to implement that plan or they lose their job. And does that concern you at all?
It concerns me, but again, it doesn't do us any good just to find problems. We have to find solutions.
Okay, so what are the solutions?
So here's what I think. I had to go back, and in the course of working on the book, actually, I went back and researched our current system. Why are we where we are? And if you think about it, our school system, our public system, was built by the Rockefellers, the Mellons, who recognized the need for an educated workforce. They didn't have enough educated employees to run these factories that we were building. So they built the public school system with basically the idea of mass producing educated employees. That worked for the industrial age. For the information age, we need an entirely different way, a different approach to teaching and learning. And yet we're still with books and blackboards and the same traditional system, bells that announce the class changes, et cetera, the same basic system that we had for the industrial
age.
The same buildings.
Go ahead.
Well, this is what gets me excited, because we are on the cusp with technology to, just like we did with space, just like we did with retail, automobiles, completely reinvent the education, the teaching and learning process. We're on the cusp. The pandemic was actually one of the best things that could have happened to education. I know it sounds crazy. It accelerated by almost 20 years the accessibility to technology, because we had no Wi-Fi. Dallas Public Schools, example, 30% of the kids had Wi-Fi.
So we got a major contribution, infusion of cash to get Wi-Fi everywhere.
Exactly. By corporations, AT&T, Dell, Apple, people stepped up, provided technology, laptops, Wi-Fi capability. So now we're connected. The question is, what do we do now with that connection? My premise is, and this is for, you know, from a corporate perspective, right? America has a hidden supply crisis. That's the human resource. If we have a chip crisis, we go build factories, right? We have a people crisis, an educated people crisis, because compared to China, as an example, they were at 40% college graduation rates over the last, since 2012, they've gone pushing 60%. That same period of time, we went from high 50s to low 40s. Dial forward 20 years, America's ability to compete globally will depend on an educated workforce. So my premise is corporate America, like we did 100 years ago, needs to step up, invest in the technology that can transform the way we teach and learn. Technology's there. We just need to do it. It's not going to happen state and local governments, right?
Right. So you have to get the private sector
exactly.
to get involved. But they got to be asked by the right way with the right plan.
Exactly. So I'm carrying the flag.
So are you centralizing – are you for centralizing education?
Not centralized. Education will always be a very personal thing, a very local thing. But what I do want to centralize is availability of the tools, accessibility. Yeah.
What about something a little bit less less practical, just more, I think, fundamental? What about teaching history? How important is it for people to realize where this nation came from?
It's critically important. Let me give you a great example. I put it in the book. Here's the power of technology. I had a friend. Their kid wasn't excited about history. Was excited about history, but wasn't excited about the classroom. Didn't like the books, didn't like the teachers, et cetera, et cetera. She said, "Can you help me coach my son?" So I did. So I said, "You know, I see you watching YouTube videos, World War II videos. Why do you like that?" He said, "Oh, I just love it. I just can't get enough." So I said, "Well, think about it. You could supplement your history class with YouTube videos. Whatever the topic is, instead of just using the textbook, use YouTube videos." This kid ended up going from a C student to an A student. He's now a freshman at Harvard.
Fantastic.
Yeah. It's the power of technology is there.
And meet them where they are.
Meet them where they are.
That's where they are. They're a visualization. They like the movies. Well, I can give you the fundamentals of the Revolutionary War through a series of fun pictures and exciting.
Exactly.
And then you go to the detail. You know what you're getting.
Exactly. So. You light up their imagination. During the pandemic, I was doing a lot of work with public schools to help this transformation using technology. And we looked at kids and they hated their classroom, right? Or their online experience. And then they play 8 hours on the same device, video games.
Right.
What's the difference? Engagement, right? Incentives. They won points. They won hat for their avatar. These are the tools we can use to dial up the graphics, to make the engagement better. We can make learning come alive.
And that's what you have in your book, Education is Freedom, the Future is in Your Hands. James Key is a great American success story. You know him. He ran Blockbuster, 7-Eleven, and knows the oil business. James, great to see you. Okay. Thanks so much for coming, and congratulations on it.
Thank you, Brian. Appreciate it.
All right, back in a moment.
Educating, entertaining, enlightening. You're with Brian Kilmeade. The more you listen, the more you'll know. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Strategically, I think we have to take a step back. And at what point does the Biden administration admit that its Middle East policy, its de-escalation policy, many would call that an appeasement policy, has gone from the Abraham Accords to open warfare between Iran and Israel, with potentially both sides launching attacks on each other from their own soil for the first time in history? It's really astounding and it's terrifying.
That is Michael Walsh responding to the attack into Iran and just by the Israelis. We pulled them back. We slowed them down. That's what we know from that has leaked out. Why? I think it's pure politics, and I think it's a cluelessness. Does anyone look at Anthony Blinken and say, that's Henry Kissinger? That's a great mind. I'm so glad he's Colin Powell, who fully understands the region. Even smart people that really are the ones that live and breathe all this can make mistakes. But I think the real dumb people are the ones that don't admit when they made a mistake. They just come in there to not acknowledge the Abraham Accords, to go in there and try to reclaim a fake relationship with Iran, give them billions of dollars in unfreezing their assets, pay them billions of dollars to get our hostages back, at the same time pull back from Saudi Arabia and vilify them, take the Houthi rebels off the terror list, and then we have October 7th. So at one point, like every good administration, you go, wow, it's a failed experiment, Bay of Pigs. Turns out we wanted Cuba out of the region. We couldn't believe communism was at our doorstep, 90 miles from Miami. There was an Eisenhower plan that Kennedy implemented, and it failed. Man, he got stronger, didn't he? That's the story of being a great administration. It's not never making a mistake. It's being mature enough to admit when something's not working and changing gears. And the American people understand it. But with 6 months left, these guys aren't capable of changing gears, it seems.
If you're interested in it, Brian's talking about it. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
I think providing lethal aid to Ukraine right now is critically important. I really do. I really do believe the intel and the briefings that we've gotten that I believe Xi and Vladimir Putin and Iran really are an axis of evil. I think they're in coordination on this. I think that Vladimir Putin would continue to march through Europe if he were allowed. I think he might go to the Balkans next.
And that is Speaker Johnson. Now, Speaker Johnson, through a series of legislative maneuvers, including getting a rule that allowed them to have a vote on Ukraine aid, and they're going to get $65 billion, $15 billion for Israel, $8 billion for Indochina. There's also going to be a border plan within that. Stephen Moore is with us right now. He's a former chief of staff in the U.S. House of Representatives and founder of the Ukraine Freedom Project, which raises money to aid Ukraine. And you just got back from Ukraine, right?
Yeah, I live in Kyiv, and I've been there since day five of the war. And so I've seen it all.
And your thoughts about what Speaker Johnson just said? Time matters.
Yeah, exactly. This needs to happen quickly. And he was right to point out that the four horsemen of the apocalypse are working together: Iran, Russia, China, and North Korea. And they're working together to cause problems in the Middle East, in Europe, in Asia, and around the world. And we need to focus on pushing back on these folks.
Why do you think so many Republicans are not for this?
Yeah, good question. Well, there's a in the House of Representatives, there's about 70 members of the Hell No Caucus that are just not going to vote for Ukraine. There's about 80 that recognize the national security implications, that recognize we're on the verge of World War III here. And then there's that middle ground of about 60 or 70 who would like to do the right thing, understand the national security implications, but are getting the snot beat out of them by their voters.
Right. And the president is now being convinced that loans, short-term loans, their forgivable loans might be the way to go. I think that when people try to minimize this, they'll say this is a conversation that Russia has to have with Ukraine. It's not our problem. What do you say to that?
Yeah. So when people talk about peace negotiations, they don't recognize that Vladimir Putin's already in violation of, I don't know, several dozen ceasefires, treaties. He's in violation of a treaty with the United States. So I am not. And no one's given me a reason to believe that Putin would honor a peace agreement right now when he hasn't honored one since he's been
in office. And he's on the front foot.
Yeah.
Right now, he's on the move.
Yeah. His army right now is bigger than it was when they started the war.
How did he do that?
Well, it's just conscription. He's conscripting a lot of people.
He's got a lot of people.
Yeah. Russia's not a free country. And so you get conscripted. And he's taken his economy from a civilian economy and he's built it up. So it's now a war economy. So people that think he's not going to go into a NATO nation are not paying attention because he's not building up this military to just have it lying around.
J.D. Vance, senator with military experience, Republican, said this.
The Israelis will need this stuff. The Taiwanese need this stuff. And of course, America needs this stuff. Can we possibly fight all of those conflicts at once? No, the math just doesn't make sense. So what we should be doing is with Ukraine, encouraging them to take a defensive posture, not these disastrous counteroffensive the Biden administration has been promoting.
I don't know where J.D. Vance served in the military, but he's not paying attention to incentives because, you got to stand up to Putin. Putin is a bully. You know, the reason that he went into Ukraine is because America showed weakness and Biden showed weakness in his withdrawal from Afghanistan. And so you can't whether we like it or not, we're in a global conflict. And so the argument that he's using is that, you know, we don't have the weapons. Well, what we need to do is we need to manufacture those weapons, and we need to put ourselves on the war footing that China, Iran, and North Korea and Russia are on.
Do they believe that's often said here, and I believe it. But when you're sitting there in Kyiv, and they say, man, if the U.S. didn't just do a ridiculous dismount from Afghanistan, if they only gave us maybe the lethal aid early on when Obama was president, if they only pushed back more, we wouldn't be in this place. They wouldn't have welled up troops. Then would they telegraphed an invasion and actually did an invasion?
Yeah. Well, what a lot of people don't know is that, you know, Russia invaded Ukraine in 2014 originally. And the president at the time came over, talked to Congress and said, please send me weapons. And Obama sent blankets. You know who sent weapons in 2017? Donald Trump. President Trump is the reason that Ukraine was able to hold off the Russians.
Javelins.
Yeah, the javelins. Yeah, exactly. So the Donald Trump sent the weapons in 2017. In 2022, the Ukrainians were able to hold off the Russians. I was in Kyiv when it was surrounded on three sides by Russians, and they used U.S. weapons to push those Russians out.
So Stephen Moore, our guest, he is founder of the Ukraine Freedom Project, and he's been over in Kyiv. He says that the city looks like a city that is not under siege. It has power?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. So I live in Kyiv. I've lived in Kyiv since the beginning of the war. And when I went there, the line to get in was really short. The line to get out was really long. And so I went there to help. And
why?
Because it's the right thing to do. Because
are you Ukrainian?
I am not Ukrainian.
You just saw this.
I lived in Ukraine for a year in 2018 and made a lot of friends, loved it. And I got a job at an artificial intelligence company, an American one, that had 500 Ukrainian employees. So I had all these Ukrainian friends.
You saw how bright they are, hardworking they are.
Hardworking, entrepreneurial, freedom loving. I mean, if the Freedom Caucus talks about freedom, but they know nothing about freedom. The Ukrainians know about freedom because they're putting everything on the line for it. So I left my job in January of 2022, and I was trying to figure out, like, what do I do next? Do I go skiing in the Alps or skiing in the Rockies? Mm-hmm. And then my friends in Ukraine started calling me and saying, they're bombing Kyiv. I don't know what to do. And I'd spent a year or almost 2 years in Iraq at the beginning of that war, so I know what to do.
So I was watching Corey Mills. I respect him tremendously. He's the one who saved led our crew operation, put an operation together to get everybody out of Afghanistan. He just saved a bunch of people in Haiti. He is now saying this is a problem that Europe really should be handling. He came out and said that he's got an accountability issue, too, with past weapons we've gotten him. And he does not believe that this president is committed to your success. So what do you say to people like that who have proven war heroes, who are Republicans, that is just not sold on the need for us to be directly involved providing all these weaponry?
Yeah. So I agree with the last one, is that the Biden administration has not done a good job.
They never talk about it.
Yeah.
They just say, of course we got to give them weapons, as long as it takes. And I hear Ukrainians hate that because they know that they'll lose that.
Yeah.
Because they have 40 million people as opposed to 125 million Russians.
Well, you and I right now are doing more to educate the American people on what's happening in this war than the president's done in 2 years.
Doesn't talk about it.
Yeah. And so
I mean, just come up with a map. Just go, hey, American people, let me just show you where we were in 1938. Let me just tell you this expansive power. Let me tell you documents that we've gotten out of Russia that shows they have designs, and they're not going to invade everybody. They're going to infiltrate Georgia like they have. Now they're in part of the Georgia's government. Moldova, they got these two breakaway republics. They keep reaching out to Russia. We got to help them out. And then Estonia, Lithuania, you start putting pro-Russian people in those countries. You don't need to fire a shot.
Yeah.
You saved the Belarus president, Lukashenko. And then you said, as a turn for a prepayment, you become a vassal state.
Yeah. And what we're seeing is that if Ukraine falls, then Russia will be on the border with 9 NATO countries. And, you know, I've heard members of Congress even say that Russia will never go into a NATO country. Well, the NATO countries that are next to Russia, who have the most information about Russia and the most to lose, are the folks that are putting the most money into Ukraine on a per capita basis.
Could they be doing more?
Europe is doing twice as much at this point as we're doing.
Proportionally.
Yeah. Yeah. No. In gross numbers. I'm telling you. So there's the Kiel Institute in Germany tracks this stuff. And I recommend that everyone listening to this go to the Kiel Institute because they track all the donations to Ukraine. Europe is now doing twice as much as we are. They don't have the defense industrial base that we do, but they're sending all kinds of other aid.
Right. Okay, good. The other problem is the limitations. I know inside Russia, there was a huge drone strike about 3 weeks ago done by the Ukrainians. We don't – evidently, we put out a statement. We don't condone this. Really?
Brian.
Is that unbelievable to you?
It is insane.
You remember what I'm talking about.
Yeah, I know exactly what you're talking about. You know, there's 12 refineries that the Ukrainians have hit since the beginning of the year. And they've taken out something like 20% of Russia's gasoline petroleum refinery capability, and that's money that they use to prosecute the war. So and the Biden administration says don't hit refineries, you know, and it's absurd.
Don't hit inside Russia.
Yeah, don't hit refineries inside Russia. Yeah, and it's just crazy. And because, you know, every day, listen, I live in Kyiv. I watch Patriot missile systems take out Kinzhal cruise missiles and Iranian drones.
Originally, you don't get HIMARS. Originally, there won't be any Patriot missile systems there.
Yeah.
Now they need to be replenished. Can you imagine if you guys, if we had a forward-thinking administration that said, we're going to give you Patriots, I think they're going to invade. We're going to get you as much weaponry as quickly as possible. They think they're going to try to take the Capitol. But yet we said they were going to do it, but we didn't do anything until they actually did it, except for famously offered Zelensky a trip like Kahani took,
yeah,
out of the country,
yeah,
with everything that he could get his arms around.
Well, and Zelensky has a lot of flaws, but I'll tell you this: at the beginning of that war, he was the president that they needed to push back on this nonsense.
What are
the
his
Biden
flaws now? You don't like what he's doing now?
Well, he is.
Fired a bunch of people.
Yeah, here's what I like what he's doing is that when corruption pops up, he takes it off at the head. And you know, the Supreme Court justice of Ukraine is in prison right now for corruption. When there was a $40 million corruption scandal in the Department of Defense, he fired the Minister of Defense and 6 of his deputies. So this is a country that's been struggling against this for decades now, and
which is one of the biggest criticisms,
yeah,
is that's a corrupt democracy. Yeah. Why are we supporting it?
Yeah, but I'll tell you this: what I've seen is that the aid money is very well protected. There's more oversight on the aid money to Ukraine than there was in Afghanistan. KPMG and Deloitte are both monitoring it, and you know, in terms of weapons, you know, I spent 5 hours coming out of Ukraine in a borderline last time. I didn't see any, you know, M777 howitzers being towed out of the country. And so there's a real sense with the aid money, people want to hang on to it.
Because you know why? Because they know, I imagine Ukrainians know, for a point of survival, if they're caught reselling this to another country, if they're caught manufacturing, giving it to the Russians, whatever it is, it's over.
Yeah.
You, without aid, you guys, as great of fighters as Ukrainians are, without aid, you're not going to be able to do anything. But this is the biggest criticism. What's happening to the money? And no one's saying that as if they know. They're saying, does every bullet go to the front line? Does all the money go where it is? I don't want to pay for pensions.
Yeah. No, those are valid things. And I'll tell you this, that the majority of the aid money, the direct aid money, is coming from the Europeans. So we are doing primarily, mm-hmm, weapons and defense-associated things.
How much is the North Korea artillery help Russia? How much has the dual-use weaponry and parts from China helped Russia? How much of those Iranian drones help Russia?
Well, I will tell you about the drones for sure. And all of those have been made a really huge impact. North Korea sent like a million shells, vast amounts. If it wasn't for these countries, Russia wouldn't be able to fight. But the Iranian drones, I think, are particularly of concern because what they've been doing is the Iranians have been shipping the drones to Russia for the last year and a half. Russia has been firing them at Ukraine. They've been testing them, what works, what doesn't work. And you know, those 300 missiles and drones that went to Israel, they were perfected in Ukraine. Yeah. So Ukraine is Iran's testing ground.
It's amazing. I mean, at first, they've got to be so embarrassing. This big behemoth Russia has to go to Iran. And then everyone was laughing when they brought in North Korea. But no one's laughing now because now the Russians are now helping North Korea with their nuclear program.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And
we're watching the new axis.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I like to refer to it as the four horsemen of the apocalypse. It's Iran, Russia, China, and North Korea. And they are, these guys are all working together. You know, in my view, we are in World War III right now, and the only people acting on that information are adversaries.
And, Steve, my last question to you, and you might not be able to answer it. He has former chief of staff in the House with the Ukrainian Freedom Project. You mentioned you moved to Kyiv. Is what would it take for us to expand for profit our military industrial base to the point where Lithuania, Taiwan, Estonia, Poland, now Sweden and Norway, they all want to buy our stuff for profit.
Yeah.
You know, maybe some like Ukraine's not going to be able to afford it for a while. But these other countries want to be customers and they are our allies. And the stronger they are, the less we're going to have to fight. So what would it take to get these companies to understand that there's money to be made at McDonnell Douglas and these other manufacturers and Raytheon?
Yeah, well, let me speak to that specifically with the drone war. Drones are the drone war is leaping in generations in Russia and Ukraine. One of those two countries is the best drone warrior in the world, and fortunately, Ukraine is our ally. But I don't see a lot of American companies over there taking advantage of the rapid innovation cycle of building a drone, putting it to the front, finding out what's wrong, and getting another one there next week. And the Ukrainians are doing that. So if it's anyone that has the best technology for drones in the world, it's the Ukrainians.
But the one with the industrial base to make it in a massive way would be the U.S., right?
Yeah. Well, there's an article in the Wall Street Journal that showed that like Skydio drones, which are a defense manufacturer, they don't work in Ukraine. A friend of mine, an American fighting in Ukraine, had two teal Golden Eagle drones, which are again, a defense firm that's got a contract with the Pentagon. He could not get them to work. So, what does work? Chinese drones, DJI. What does work is Ukrainian drones. So this is a wake-up call, Brian. We need to be awake. We need to wake up and make sure we're getting with the program with our defense industrial.
And I just think if it explained effectively, if someone understood systems and massive manufacturing – this is a for-profit industry. As Americans, we kind of like that.
Well, man.
It's a win-win.
Yeah. We're capitalists, last time I checked.
Steve, I appreciate everything you're doing. I think the cause is great. And soon, I hope, you walk out of here knowing $65 billion is behind you.
Yeah.
Because we have to be successful.
Absolutely.
All right. Stephen Moore, thanks. Back with your calls in a moment. You're listening to the Brian Kilmeade Show.
It's Brian Kilmeade. Radio that makes you think. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
We make revolution by building beautiful things, and Colombia squashes that by destroying those beautiful things.
How so?
Well, we came together peacefully to assemble with love and with prayer and with respect for all human beings for the freedom of Palestine. And Columbia University has responded with violence through the use of the NYPD to suppress all efforts at free speech and to suppress peaceful revolution through the building of beautiful things.
If you have applied to Columbia, I would go to your number two school because that is a little about – it's a Columbia student. Now, I don't think he's a freshman, so I think he's got 3 years of training. What a knucklehead. And for his sake, I hope he's high, because that's the way he's functioning without illegal drugs or legal drugs these days. It's hard to believe. Here's John Schell, the NYPD chief of patrol, what he found in New York City. Cut 26.
The students went peacefully. What was a little concerning was that all the students that came out of the classrooms and surrounded us with some vile language towards the NYPD, and very disturbing to see. But our department acted brilliantly today. The plan was flawless. We got it done. No issues, no physical altercations, and removed the kids from the school. So like I said, it was a good collective effort with the Columbia, the NYPD, and it just shows what we can do here in New York City when it comes to protesters.
But he also said, look, you could have called us earlier. By the time we got there, there was all this encampments, all these pup tents, and the kids did not want to leave, and they used vile language at the cops.
Fox News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan. It's the fastest growing radio talk show. Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. So glad you're here. Thanks for being with us all week long. I don't remember a time when I saw five major stories that all are breaking throughout the show. And, you know, a little bit slower today, but throughout the week, I mean, I'm just, you look up and there's a major boat. You look up and we're hearing about an Israeli attack or receiving. And then we hear about a Hezbollah being taken out and hear about the latest on the court case and the shocking story, losing two jurors. And it's just a lot of moving parts. That makes this job so fun. You never know what's going to happen. Chan and Bream are standing by. They're going to take a break from all the political stuff and have some fun in baseball. One of the greatest players of his generation, Joe Carter, former Major League Baseball All-Star and World Series MVP. He's playing at the with Brett Baer at the Celebrity Classic, the third annual invited Celebrity Classic. So Brett's going to be out there and Joe Carter. I don't often put them in the same breath, but I should more often. Brett is an awesome golfer, and we had John Smoltz on yesterday, so Joe Carter's going to be calling us from the green. So let's get to the big three.
Now with the stories you need to know, it's Brian's Big Three.
Number three.
The average person really does want to put bias aside. The problem is that you have highly motivated people in New York, and some of them, I think, could very well lie on the stand and not disclose their bias, the hatred towards Trump.
That is Jonathan Turley worrying, like we all do, that the jury's not going to be fair in New York City, where the president, former president, got 15% of the vote. They've gotten 12 jurors. Now it's time to fill up the alternate roster. It makes me uneasy. What about you? We'll also give you the latest on 2024. We have a battleground poll to go over.
Number two.
Students have a right to free speech, but do not have a right to violate university policies and disrupt learning on campus. That heartbreak does not give you the right to harass others, to spread hate.
True, Mayor Adams. I agree with you. The Columbia crackdown. The pro-Palestinian, pro-Hamas ivy exposes themselves as an anti-American bastion. Time now to suspend the heretics, weakening, we are wreaking havoc on our city streets and disrespecting the NYPD.
Number one.
I think the most important question for the Israelis is, what do they want to achieve here? And I think they made up their mind that they wanted to achieve a limited, narrow attack to de-escalate the situation, and it would not put pressure on Iran to retaliate.
General Jack Keane with me this morning. Israel attacks Iran in Iran. As the sun comes up, we review the damage as Iran weighs a response, and Israel doesn't even technically take responsibility for it. But the good news is Joe Biden did. Shannon Bream joins us now. You know her. She's set to host Fox News Sunday. She's going to be picking out outfits. She's going to be spray painting the studio, make sure it's all brand new, all the lights work. You do everything, don't you, Shannon?
I was thinking a little graffiti, like a little artistic license.
Right. Just a big SB
keep
in the back.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
why is it Fox News Sunday? Why isn't it Shannon Bream Talks?
Because I do let other people talk.
Oh.
Shannon Bream and other people talking.
Right. That. How about that?
Right. I think that's a great, very catchy name for a show.
All right. I'll call your staff.
Okay, please do.
And I'm going to call the logo shop. We're going to change some things. Shannon, first off, it's an interesting strike last night. Israel did it. We don't know exactly what happened. If you read the reports from Reuters, they say three drones were taken out of the air by their missile defense. And if you understand some of the reports from where that was located, being a nuclear facility and a military base, your thoughts?
Well, it seems like it was put together to send a message, but not to escalate things out of control. We know that the U.S. had advance warning. We didn't greenlight it. We weren't involved with it. But even Iran seems to say, like, okay, we're done. Like, at least the immediate back and forth between Iran and Israel is done. Everybody's said their piece. You know, of course, Hamas is out there saying, like, oh, no, this was escalatory and provocative, and Iran should definitely respond. Obviously, they want Israel to be taking heat from all sides, multiple fronts. But it looks like the Iran-Israel thing, for the moment, is quiet.
Yeah, I mean, so far no one's saying that. Is that the best you can do? You know, the old bravado thing, mm-hmm. like a boxing match that we heard back and forth after last weekend strikes. I understand everybody wants to de-escalate. Nobody wants World War III. But the status quo is okay for Iran, but it's not okay from Israel. I mean, you have these people 200 miles in the north, out of their homes, unable to work, unable to go to school. They still have bills they got to pay. It's been 6-7 months. Hostages that are slowly dying. The numbers are dwindling. Hamas just remains in Rafah, who's ever left. The status and Hezbollah rocketing regularly. Two commanders were wiped out a couple of days ago. So I'm wondering the next move is going to really need a deep thinker. I mean, you just can't react emotionally, right? But you can't continue to exist like this if you're Israel.
Right. And you do on so many different fronts you mentioned there. I mean, the fact is we have hostages. Some of them are American. They have not come home. This is months and months of them being held while we've got Qatar in the interim, you know, kind of facilitating. They give comfort, people would argue, to Hamas, to its leaders. And the U.S., a lot of people are now starting to argue, should be tougher on them to get those hostages home, that if they really crack down, if they drop the hammer on Hamas, that we would get more done. So we've given Qatar, you know, special status. We have our largest Middle East base. There are all kinds of ways that we could enact more leverage on them, and there are more calls for that as the rest of this plays out.
Here is Dave Ignatius. He is as great a foreign policy contact as anyone. Cut seven.
Israel needs to be thinking, as it enters this new stage of action and reaction, about its role as leader of the anti-Iran coalition. That is the position that it's taken after defeating Iran's missile barrage. It's something very precious. It's a gateway to a more stable future for Israel. And I hope Israeli officials are thinking carefully, as they've been counseled to do by the White House, not to in any way jeopardize that role by actions that seem to be unwise overreactions that plunge the whole region into region-wide war that would be damaging for everyone, for Jordan, for Saudi Arabia, for all the countries that might be involved.
Delicate time, Shannon, but the secret weapon that Israel has, people like them better than they do the Iranians, and it's really a choice, correct?
Yeah, absolutely. And you'll notice that there are many folks in the region that seemed that they allowed their airspace to be used for Israel to go deliver its message to Iran. And listen, there are people there in the region. Remember the Abraham Accords under the Trump administration. There you're inching toward normalized relationships and better relationships between Israel and a number of Arab countries and its neighbors, you know, trying to get things done. And you're right. When it comes to Iran, it was refreshing that everybody seemed to be pretty united in one voice around the world. Like, okay, this was a bad thing. These are bad guys. You know, there's no question. But then it raises the question about Hamas. I think everybody also agrees Hamas, bad dudes. They came after Israel. They did heinous things. But the fact that they hide among civilians and use them as shields make it so much more complicated. But as you heard there with David Ignatius saying, we're giving a lot of direction and management, it seems like, to Israel. And people ask, okay, well, why don't we do that in other places like Ukraine? We're not micromanaging what Zelensky is doing. And it raises questions. Is some of what President Biden is doing in response to the voters he may need in the fall?
Yes, but I'll pretend as if it's.
You're pretending that's a rhetorical question?
Yes, I'm pretending. I know you. Everybody knows the answer to that. But it was so interesting when they were protesting the president's speeches in Pennsylvania. It's the first time I heard the anti-Bidenomics with signs printed up. And they look like Biden voters. They just they are upset with the economy. The weird thing is Joe Biden's running on it. He's not running from it. He's running on it. There's a bit of a disconnect when people show up with your greatest asset and they focus their derision on it.
Well, and two, when you have people who are close to the Biden administration and, you know, former White House chief of staff saying, quit going out there and talking about Bidenomics and bridges and stuff like that. People can't buy groceries. I mean, there's real world stuff that people, you know, you can say, oh, the polls haven't caught up to reality yet. No, it's reality for people. And so obviously, you know that when you're going out saying things like I'm going to get, you know, you're going to get student loans forgiven and I'm going to do all these other things that are going to help you. He knows financially there's trouble. And that is the reality for people. So you can talk about Bidenomics all day long, but if you'll note, the president and Democrats have mostly stopped using that term. The White House keeps going back to it, but it's really not their strongest argument, especially when inflation ticked up last month.
That is true. What's your impression? I'm in the middle of New York, and we have downtown, we got the court case, and Uptown, we have the Columbia, what I thought were riots. So maybe I'm too New York centric, but I do believe that yesterday that was the big story. And these students who tried to show up their president, who was trying to, in my view, quell everyone's worry about Columbia being a bastion of anti-Semitism, they timed it perfectly to make her look as if she was not being candid. I want you to hear some of the exchanges with this protester. Cut 29.
You're from Kentucky. I mean, you're from the middle of America. There's a lot of people, you know, who are seeing this that think you guys are anti-American. What's your response to that?
Well, I would ask them what they mean by America. Because if you mean the land, I don't think many people love the land as much as I do. I love where I'm from. My family's got just a little homestead in Kentucky, and we're working to make it productive. We're working to be self-sustaining. And if your idea of America is the land, then we are the most American people you can possibly imagine. If your vision of America is to support the imperialist global hegemony of the United States Empire through military domination and through building military bases more so than any other country in the world all around the globe to encircle the competing imperial powers, then no, I can't say I'm American in that way.
So which America did you choose, Jenny? You only have two. It was going so well for a while. And then I forgot about the fact that we want to have bases everywhere to protect freedom around the world, or we're just trying to give bullets to natives instead of money.
He sounded like he started out like Matthew McConaughey and it ended up like Joseph Stalin. I mean, like, it was quite an arc there.
Right. Do you want to use that soundbite? I'll license it to you.
Thank you very much. I feel like that's somebody with too much time on their hands. I mean, that's how it felt to me, because working a homestead is hella hard work. I mean, the heart of our country that's producing our food and doing all that kind of stuff. I mean, these people are hardworking. I don't know where he got a little bit off track there, because without the security and safety of being able to operate in America, you don't really have your homestead. So there's a lot going on there.
I just thought you'd enjoy that.
I did very much.
Who's going to be on your Sunday show?
Well, we have got Dupree and Turley with us to break down all the legal stuff, the jurors, what we know about them, that trial going into opening arguments next week, and the Supreme Court next week hears the immunity arguments. And so that's huge for the federal cases. We'll see what happens there. Congressman Moskowitz is going to be with us to talk about all this fighting over the foreign aid. I think they're stuck here this weekend. And I should be able to announce a Republican momentarily. I'll do it on the socials.
Yeah, well, I mean, we know the ones who are against it. We know that a lot of Republicans are against it. And get this, I'm watching, and you know this, I'm not pretending like you don't, but it doesn't look like the squad wants to give Israel money. So a lot of Republicans don't want to give Ukraine money. The squad doesn't want to give Israel money. So these votes are going to be quite blended.
Everybody's got some big decisions to make. And does it cost the speaker his speakership? He doesn't really seem to worry about that calculus, as you know him and talk with him as I do. He just wants to keep it moving. He says he's doing his job. He's not worrying about keeping his job.
So it seems like Speaker Johnson is speaking now, and he's making remarks after the foreign aid bill advances. So it advances. It's not going to be finalized till tomorrow, which will change the show tomorrow, obviously. One Nation is going to change your show. But I expect it to pass. And here's why. I don't think any Democrat, Shannon, wants to get rid of Speaker Johnson, because he's not doing things that they're upset with, which doesn't mean he's doing a Democrat thing, but he's talking about foreign aid. You know, he's not building windmills. He's doing foreign aid that you would think Ronald Reagan would have signed up off on 6 months ago.
Well, and listen, he's trying to say to his right flank, I hear you. I agree. We need to get stuff done on the border. There are other messages and packages that are coming together. But in the meantime, nobody gets everything they want. And he's going to have to work with Democrat votes to get these things passed. And listen, he says he has seen enough intel and argument that it's got to get done. So do you put these together in packages that will make people vote for either Israel or Ukraine? You got to have both. It looks like that is what he's doing. I mean, the House is voting on these as separate measures, but the way technically they put it together, you know, it's got to go back together over to the Senate in a package. So we'll see.
So Chad Pergram has just put out, it's extraordinary. The minority party would provide so many votes for a rule. He has not seen that. This was a test vote, not only on the aid package, but he goes on. So the Democrats are delivering the aid package that Republicans are just standing down on. it seems.
Right. And the thing is, they all know the debacle of the last time they got rid of a speaker. So they help him get these things passed. And then it sounds like Democrats will help him if a motion to vacate comes. I don't think they wanted to do that before Ukraine aid got across the finish line. But it sounds like they will help keep him alive. Everybody knows you get rid of a speaker, the House literally cannot do anything. No business on anything if you don't have a speaker. Last time it took 3 weeks, 15 votes and a lot of deal making that, you know, included measures that are now kind of coming back to haunt whoever is the new speaker. So we'll see. Democrats part of the process in saving the speaker for sure.
Yeah, he said Dems would be willing to protect Johnson, it seems. That's not to say that such a large chunk of Dems would vote to support Johnson, but a wide swath of Democrats would likely try to bail Johnson out. Incredible. Shannon, it's going to be exciting. And I know you're going to be watching One Nation Saturday and then restructuring your show around everything I produce. Saturday at 9 p.m. Thank you very much.
I'm using that Matthew McConaughey boy.
You got it. Back in a moment.
Okay, bye.
Diving deep into today's top stories, it's Brian Kilmeade. Breaking news, unique opinions. Hear it all on the Brian Kilmeade Show.
All right, let's go out to Tim. Listen to WNIS in beautiful Virginia Beach. Hey, Tim.
Hey, Brian, how you doing?
Good.
Hey, one of the things that irritates me over the past 3.5 years is you really can't call this the Biden administration. Nobody really thinks this Rhodes Scholar president has the brains to put all this together. He's getting all this information. He's being fed to him, and he's not doing a good job of delivering on it, obviously. But I've come to call it the Geppetto Obama and Ginocchio relationship, you know, so they just keep feeding him. He keeps stumbling, and we keep getting deeper in debt and deeper in trouble.
I don't think it's Obama, though.
Call me crazy.
I just don't think it's Obama. What? I think it's Jake Sullivan and Anthony Blinken are doing most of the work. I guess this guy, Jeff Zients. But because Obama is really not, I don't think they're good friends. And I was talking to someone yesterday who is in regular touch with Obama. They talk 4 or 5 times a week. And he just says there's no way. He's going to help out in the fall. He provides advice to his campaign. But he's not doing it. And I'm telling you, we know about the AI stuff. We know that he's been an advisor on AI. Why they didn't announce it? But I don't see his fingerprints on this. I'm not sure who's doing it. If Rahm Emanuel was chief of staff, I would say Rahm Emanuel's running the country because he's such a strong personality. But the only people I ever see talking is Jake Sullivan and Anthony Blinken. And, you know, we see Jed Bernstein speak about the economy. But now he doesn't come out anymore because people don't like, you know, they don't like where the economy is right now. So you don't even see him. You see this, Tim. You really see you see things happen. You see America react. But no one ever explains. And for some reason, the press is totally okay with that. That him never speaks, never does a sit-down interview, never gives a speech, never puts out a paper, never tells us how he thinks. Sources say within the White House they feel. That's not good enough.
The fastest 3 hours in radio. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
Joe has had his moments. 2 balls and 2 strikes on him. Here's a pitch on the way. A swing and a belt. Left field. Way back. Blue Jays win it. The Blue Jays are World Series champions as Joe Carter hits a 3-run home run in the 9th inning, and the Blue Jays have repeated as World Series champions. Touch them all, Joe. You'll never hit a bigger home run in your life.
And that is the narrative to every kid who plays baseball in the backyard. Home run, bottom of the ninth to win the World Series. The problem was, not the problem, the great thing for Joe Carter is he did it. And he did it in 1993. That won the series for him in Game 6. But now Joe Carter's focused on golf. It's the 3rd annual Invited Celebrity Classic, and he's one of the invited. The headliner's Brett Baer, Fox News. But Joe Carter's pretty good in his own right. Joe, what are your thoughts when you heard that? When you heard that again, or do you hear it every day?
Well, you know, what Brian, what I tell everybody is, you know, I did hit more than one home run. No, every time I hear that, it takes me back to that at bat. It takes me back to the on deck circle at the plate. You know, it's something that I'll never forget. And the great thing is a lot of people will never forget it either. So that's a good thing. And I don't know about, you know, you made one statement. Brett Baer is the, I mean, he's the top dog here. Now we're going to see about that. We've got something in store for Brett today.
No, I know. You got some huge names there. Greg Maddux, Tom Glavine, of course, you, Joe, Albert Pujols, Brian Urlacher, Robbie Gould, fantastic kicker, one of the great catchers of all time, Pudge Rodriguez, up this field. The PGA Tour Champions Professionals, 54 holes of stroke play for a purse of $2 million. Joe, what kind of player are you?
Well, my index right now is a 1.4. So I love playing golf. I love to compete. And, you know, us baseball players, when you get out to baseball, you know, about all you have left is golf because you don't want to do any more running. And we still like the swinging, the club, and our hand-eye coordination is pretty good. And speaking of golf, you know, the home run that I hit, that was just a pitching wedge down and in, 135 yards. So, I mean, no, I've played golf a lot, love to compete, and this is going to be a great tournament. The thing is, Brian, man, with the ball players out here, they are – it is some great golfers. We've got 40 celebrities, and I'm telling you what – I'd probably say 30 of them are scratch golfers.
Wow.
It's just that good.
So I know Tony Romo won last year, and we heard how great Smoltz is in the past. And I remember Rick Roden was a fantastic golfer. I know he made the transition. In terms of wear and tear in your body, I get it. In the 30s, you become a different player. 35, every once in a while, there's a Tom Brady that plays into his 40s. But as a golfer, how much of your athleticism is still there? When did you notice it waning and you had to adjust your game?
When did I notice the golf talent?
No, like when it comes with your age. How does it relate to age? I know how it relates in baseball. What about golf?
No. You know what? It doesn't relate the same in golf because all you do is go out and get better equipment. The equipment that you're making, they have, you know, you can swing the club faster. The driver's more forgiving. I can still hit it 300 yards. And so that's, you know, never mind, I'm 64 years old. So, you know, golf is always evolving. And why not? Because this is what, I mean, whether you're a football player, basketball, baseball, hockey, doesn't matter. I mean, you'll always end up playing golf. And I think I asked somebody the other day, I'm like, well, what do the golfers do when they retire? Do they go out and play golf? And they said, nah, we don't go out and play that much golf.
They don't play baseball.
Golf courses. No, they go out and build golf courses. That's what they do.
So Joe, when you go out and go into the locker room, is that some of the most fun, talking to the other guys from different sports and different eras, and even the guys from your own era?
Yeah, no, it is. I mean, it's all about the people you meet in the game of baseball and the game of golf. You know, being when I was in Toronto and you had the Canadian Open there and guys like Freddie Couples, Davis Love, all those guys would come into the clubhouse. We talk to them. They want to talk baseball. We want to talk golf, you know, and vice versa. So, you know, and, you know, they are great fans of the game and we're great golf fans. So, you know, you want to pick their brain and see how they handle different situations, how they handle pressure because, you know, in baseball, we sit here, the ball is coming at us. Mm-hmm. In golf, it's just sitting there waiting for us to hit it. And so much can go through your mind. So it's taking with golf, it's taking your mind out of it and just going by your repetitions and believing and trusting your swing. It's mental. It definitely is. Yogi Berra said it best. 90% of the game is physical. The other half is mental.
April 19th to the 21st at Las Colinas Country Club in Irving, Texas. Tickets are free. The Invited Celebrity Classic. Go to invitedcelebrityclassic.com and go out there and see your players. And when they're done, no one's more approachable than baseball players once you're done. But when you guys are playing, it's tough. Walking on the field, I remember trying to get interviews, especially when my mic flag said sports phone. It's hard to get a hold of Joe Carter's attention with that. But, Joe, let's talk about the game if we can today. Are you thinking it's in a good place? More and more sports experts, not necessarily baseball fans, would say it's become more regional than ever. Your thoughts?
Wow. I mean, the game itself has totally changed. Brian, I mean, if you look at statistics, and baseball players always measure by statistics, and how many guys are hitting 200 and below. I mean, it is a lot of people And baseball, Major League Baseball, is paying a lot of money for that because of this analytics, how they've come into it. They're incorporating the launch angle. It's not about putting the ball in play. It's about swinging up and trying to hit the ball out of the ballpark. And, you know, you see a lot of strikeouts, a lot of fly balls, and bad averages. But it doesn't matter because that's the way the game is right now. Do I like it? I mean, it's the time. Everybody has to change. And this is what these young guys, this is what they do. They hit a home run. They're going to celebrate, you know, as if it was the seventh game of the World Series. And here it is, the fourth week of the season. So, you know, it is what it is. But I definitely liked it better when we put the ball in play. We got the runners over. You know, we did what it took to win the ball game. You know, it was all about team and not all about the antics. But, man, it's right now for me, it's tough to watch.
Right. You're talking about a guy who hit almost 400 homers in his career and had a lot of success over the course of his career. I thought it was interesting. During your time, the Yankees were spending like crazy, and they weren't winning. You know, they would get pieces, Oscar Gamble, Jesse Barfield. They get different players, but they wouldn't gel. The Dodgers are spending, and they're winning. They seem to get the right players with the right farm system. Why do you think it's working? They're able to sign the best players and grow players and just absorb that luxury tax. It doesn't matter to them.
Yeah, well, for one thing, you look at the ownership. Magic Johnson is involved. You look at the manager, Dave Roberts, who is a very – you know, he played the game, and he played it well, and he knew the fundamentals, and he knew what chemistry was and what camaraderie was. And so – everybody, if you look at every team, all these guys were, you know, in high school, they were, you know, All-State. They hit third and fourth on their teams. They were a pitcher, shortstop, third baseman, all those things. And so now what is the difference? How do you get those guys to believe in one another and not worry about being the best player, but worry about being the best teammate?
Yeah.
And when you have 25 guys come together like that with no ego, you'd be amazed at how well you could play. In 92, 93, the Jays, I mean, we had all-stars. We had had Hall of Famers. But you know what? Everybody was approachable. This is like, hey, this is a 25-man team. We need everybody to succeed. And so I'm going to bring the rookies in, the things that were taught to me when I was a rookie. I'm going to teach to the rookies as a veteran, but we're going to be, you know, accountable. You know, if the veterans are lacking off, then, you know, the rookies can tell us. It's not that, you know, rookies can be seen but not heard. No, that's not the way it goes. And so Dave Roberts done a great job in putting all that team together and getting them to play and have some fun.
Right. I'm talking to Joe Carter. And Joe, finally, who's all excited, and why wouldn't he be? When do you tee off today?
I tee off at 12:02 Central Time. So
okay.
I got one of the late times, which is good. So I could rest. But tomorrow is supposed to be like 94% chance of rain. So that's going to be ugly all day tomorrow.
So you got to be flexible, obviously. They're going to be pulling you off and on because they wanted to tear up the course. So Joe, lastly, before I let you go, there's two things. And I went to Cooperstown for the first time last year, and I could not be more impressed. In fact, I went with two people that aren't baseball fans were in awe of it. You guys have one of the best Hall of Fames, I think, around. I think you agree. But number two is I don't have the hits leader in there, and I don't have the home run leader in there. What should be done about that, Pete Rose and Barry Bonds?
Well, I mean, if I had the answer, I'd let you know.
But what do you think should be done?
What do I think should be done? Very, very tough. I mean, what Pete, you know, I think if Pete had come out when all of this first happened, I think he would be in the Hall of Fame. But because he denied it the whole time up until it was his last year of eligibility, then it cast a red flag on everything. With Barry was my teammate. You know, before the steroids, Barry was a Hall of Famer. I mean, he was the only guy in the 500-400 club. So if you go back and say from the steroid era, you wipe out all the stats, he's still a Hall of Famer. So will he get in? I'm not sure. But he was still one of the best ball players I ever played with.
Was he good to you as a teammate?
Well, Barry, I knew how to handle Barry because Bobby, his father was my hitting coach. So, I knew how to handle Barry. The thing about Barry, Barry played the tough guy because that's the way he felt he had to be. But behind the scenes, no, Barry was unbelievable. I tell this story all the time, and I even told it at his retirement. We're in San Francisco and we're taking BP, and this kid comes out with a sign and says, "It's my birthday. All I want to do is meet Barry Bonds." Well, Barry was not taking BP that day because he was in the training room relaxing. And so I grab the kid, take him inside, and Barry talks to this kid for about an hour. Takes him around the clubhouse, gives him all these things for his birthday. And see, no one sees that but us. And so, you know, and yeah. Barry likes to, you know, he was very guarded. But I think over the years he has calmed down and matured in that aspect as far as the public. Because, you know, once we get through with the game, you know, the game will go on without us. And I think he's realizing that. But behind the scenes, no, Barry was a great guy.
Great knowledge, they say. He's a real student of the game, obviously. A great player.
Yes, yes.
I do remember when him and Bobby Bonilla came up, and I thought to myself, the Pirates are going to be good for the next 15 years. But they weren't able to hold on to them. Joe Carter, thanks so much. Best of luck today. I'm predicting great things for your three rounds, rain or not. It's all part of the Invited Celebrity Classic. You can get tickets if you're in Irving, Texas, at invitedcelebrityclassic.com. Thanks, Joe.
All right, thank you, Brian. Have a good day.
All right, you too. When we come back, I'll finish up with some calls, some final thoughts. Keep in mind, we're going to add this. One Nation is coming up Saturday night. We'll be on at 9 o'clock. I got Jim Trusty is going to be with us for sure. Steve Mosher is going to break down how China has infiltrated every aspect of our lives and how we got to begin to fight back quickly. And Mike Rowe is going to be with us too. And you're going to hear the bare-knuckle boxer. We're going to see Bobby Gunn. This is a story like you've never heard before, all coming up on One Nation. That'll be Eastern Time, Saturday night at 9 p.m. Don't move.
Want even more, Brian? Download the podcast at BrianKilmeadShow.com. Every episode, exclusive interviews, on demand. More of Kilmeade coming up. The talk show that's getting you talking. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
He flew those single-engine planes as reconnaissance over war zones. And he got shot down in New Guinea, and they never found the body because there were a lot of cannibals for real in that part of New Guinea.
Look, I don't have anything beyond about what I just laid out, but it was a really proud moment for him.
Yes, who wouldn't be proud of an uncle who disappeared out of nowhere? And was eaten by cannibals. And there's no way to verify that story, just like there's no way to verify most stories that Joe Biden tells. That's why he doesn't talk much, and they don't put him on the campaign trail much. But it was a bit of a boomerang. Eric, I don't know if it caught you by surprise. I did not think we'd be talking about Joe Biden's uncle that died in World War II and was eaten by cannibals. Were you expecting that?
No. I mean, he says a lot of things, but when I saw the headline come across yesterday, we could not stop laughing.
And how about that to emerge? And of course, they had to keep away from the press. And you know, everyone's like, "What?" And then they try to look it up. There's no record of him being eaten by cannibals. One guy survived. Did anyone want to ask that guy that survived? He might be 96 at this point. But the first person I look for traditionally is survivors, as opposed to, and that's what he's ad-libbing. And then he went off and off on a few tangents. A couple of things I'm going to be talking about over the weekend, and that is, you know, Donald Trump for opponents is a target-rich environment. He just says a lot of controversial things that people feel as though he's susceptible on. But with Joe Biden's going at him for the weirdest things. He says, "Oh, on the economy, he's hanging out in Mar-a-Lago with all his billionaire friends looking to give him tax cuts." Excuse me? Donald Trump has got almost no billionaire friends, number one. Number two, he's known as a blue-collar guy taking all the blue-collar votes. And the tax plan that he put out cut 1%. So nobody thinks that he's out there for the rich. And he talks about the bottom up and the middle out. That's never been done in any economic principle. You don't turn around an economy on the tax-paying working class. You turn around the economy by getting investment into the economy. And where does that come from? For the most part, the rich, the successful, who should be looked up to, not vilify, but I digress. Then he says, well, I act tough on China. My previous guy just talked tough. He didn't do anything. I don't know. You hear Huawei? We basically pushed back by that company out of North America. Did you hear about phase one of the economic plan? That was a reconfiguration, the beginning until the pandemic hit, of our relationship, trade relationship with China. Have you ever heard of the China virus that caused such outrage? That was Donald Trump being provocative and direct. You caused this virus, China. It's your fault. And everyone was outraged. Did anyone ever hear of, tariffs? First thing Donald Trump did is put huge tariffs on the biggest imports of Chinese goods. And they were so effective, they're still there. So what I'm trying to say is, if you feel as though a guy's chin's out, why are you trying to take him at the body? So there's nothing there. And then when you talk about my economy, they were protesting outside your event in Pennsylvania. I believe it was your hometown. A Bidenomics being such a disaster. And you talk about the adults being back in the room and bring some class back to the White House. The same day a story emerges that inside emails among staffers, they call Trump Hitler. And the president used an expletive, an effing expletive, to describe Trump every chance he gets. I don't know. Is that class back at the White House? And then you walk into a gas station the day after Donald Trump is treated like a rock star at the Bodega Association and out of the streets of Harlem, and nobody comes up to you. You don't even walk up to a child. And when it was time to order, you ordered a milkshake for yourself. Trump ordered food for everybody at Chick-fil-A. So his instincts are off. His attack plan isn't effective. There are 10 ways to attack Donald Trump. You actually fortified him. It's going to be an interesting 6 months.
There are a lot of cannibals.
Kudlow on Fox Business is now on the go for podcast fans. Get key interviews with the biggest business newsmakers of the day. The Kudlow podcast will be available on the go after the show every weekday at foxbusinesspodcasts.com or wherever you download your favorite podcasts. Listen to the show ad-free on Fox News Podcast Plus, on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music with your Prime membership, or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.